This is A Lost Plot, the podcast where we explore meaning in movies together. Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back to another episode of A Lost Plot. I am your host, as always, Maverick here. And today we have our wonderful guest back with us again, Patrick Avanto. Patrick.
I'm not here to take over the podcast. I'm not.
He always brings in, like, one thing you'll always see with Patrick is he brings in the interesting films. You're not going to see the streamlined stereotypes that everyone else is wanting to see. No, you're going to get the interesting bits with Patrick. So that's what he's here for.
I love it. I love it. And that's, I'll watch the other films, but they don't spark as much discussion in me. That's why I love to recommend, like, the weird ones.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And I honestly, sometimes it puts me in out of my normal routine. I've definitely watched some movies I wouldn't have watched some movies that I've been meaning to watch, but not many other people are interested in watching, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So, always love it. Anyways, you all know what you're here for because you saw it in the title. It's Pan's Labyrinth.
Pan's Labyrinth.
That's
by
right.
Guillermo del Toro from 2006.
That's right. That's right. It's a Spanish dark fantasy, and it is the translation is The Labyrinth of the Faun, which I thought
yes.
was interesting because it's not what it's translated as in our title as
nope.
English watchers. Written by Guillermo del Toro and directed by the same. It's starring Ivana Baquero as Ophelia or Princess Moana. Is that what it, how it
yes.
was said? Yeah.
Yes. Moana.
Which is it's not like in the not in like the Disney movie.
This ain't a Disney fantasy. This ain't.
That's right. It's got Sergi Lopez as Captain Vidal and Mirabel Verdú as Mercedes and more. But anyways.
I do have to mention, though, famous creature actor Doug Jones. If you've seen like Mimic or Hellboy or other films like that, typically he tends to work with Guillermo del Toro.
Okay.
He usually plays the really skinny creatures because he's very skinny.
Yeah, is he as skinny as his legs are made out to be when he's that monstrosity in the dining room?
That was some fun CG. It was easier to use him for that section because he wore a prosthetic leg piece that went over his leg, and then the rest of his leg was covered in a green screen that they just keyed out.
Interesting.
And it's pretty convincing. I really like that part.
Yeah. Oh, I do too. Yeah. Anyways, we'll get into it. We don't
yeah.
want to get too much in the weeds yet, but before we get into it, as always, Patrick, could you please enlighten us? What is Pan's Labyrinth about?
Pan's Labyrinth is a dark fantasy that takes place during the, if I recall, the Spanish Civil War, following a young girl named Ophelia, who her and her mother move into a sort of farm compound with her new stepfather, who happens to be the general fighting the resistance. While she lives there, the main theme of the movie is she finds her escape and solace in a sort of fantasy that blurs the line between fiction and reality for her, where she comes across a faun and is tasked with a bunch of these very obscure, very oddly specific tasks to do while she's living on the compound. And in return, her her reward is going to be basically going down into the great city underneath and become the princess she was meant to be. There's a lot more to it than that, but I've already said a few things to lean towards what I feel the themes of the movie are. I very much enjoy, before I even talk about the film, I really enjoy the cinematography and like the colors of this movie. It's very Guillermo del Toro-esque. It's dark, but it always has like a very nice contrast of colors that go into it as well. Certain
yeah.
parts are very dark and blue, somewhat purplish in some of how dark the blues are. And then you get vibrant golds and reds. There's a lot of discussion about how he writes his characters, and particularly how he writes his villains, how he writes his protagonists. He works a lot with children. Children as the protagonists. And that's an important thing in regards to the plot line of this one. Also,
yeah.
he does focus a lot on the Spanish Civil War and a lot of like World War II and kind of war-torn countries, but in the midst of being war-torn as a civilian. He has
okay.
I don't know if you saw the Netflix Pinocchio by Guillermo del Toro. That's a stop motion animated film.
No, I did not.
It's very good. Also okay. takes place right during, I believe it's World War II. Okay. Then there's another one of his, another all Spanish one called The Devil's Backbone, which is, again, war torn, takes place at an orphanage, and a bunch of them are kind of like in that vein. And that's where he thrives in writing that kind of story. He's very grounded when it comes to the setting, but he likes to twist it with a bit of fantasy in a way that's not always what you expect it to be.
Yeah, he was very interesting for sure. I know he had a different take on what a lot of people have perceived things as just right off the bat. I mean, even with the we'll get into it. So I should stop my ramblings. Let's, you know, you caught me monologuing. So anyways,
you caught me monologuing. It was me. I'll admit.
the opening scene. Did you think that this opening scene was one that really caught your attention and made you want to keep watching? Oh, yes. Wait. Before we get into that, what am I doing? The review. Okay, what did you give this movie on the 9-point rating system?
On the rating scale, it pumped out an 8.75.
Whoa.
Which is interesting because I never feel like I need to rate this movie. So giving it a numeric value makes me go, does that seem too high for what it is? But I also have no complaints about the movie at all. So,
yeah,
that's, I always want to like say when I look at this kind of like rating scale, I want to give it a margin of one on either side, or that'd be degrees of freedom, 1 degree of freedom. So like that center score is prone to change to a 7 or 9 is what I'd say, just kind of to round down to the whole value. I'd keep it at 8 though.
That's actually a good perspective to take. I found that even in these discussions, normally when I'm having a discussion with someone, at most, I see it go down by a full point rating system or go up by a full point rating system based on the conversations and somebody pointing out something I didn't see before. But overall, it's decently close to where I originally rated. So that's probably one of the merits of the system.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
How low did you score it?
You are like, I know you got it lower.
I know what it's like, man. Part of my rating also happens because I've watched this movie so many times, the questions on your scale always have a bit more of a complex answer for me, which is why it tends to not really lay in the medium, in like it's okay versus the bad versus the high. It's either low or high because I've seen it for long enough to have formed very strong opinions about things, which, sorry.
No, that's good. We love strong opinions on this podcast.
Oh yeah.
I gave it a 6.15. Mm-hmm. So yes. So it's that for me is like, this is a solid movie. I definitely enjoyed watching it. Would watch it again.
Yeah.
But I will say for this one, there were multiple times where I put down a rating, put down a thought, and said, I am very open to being convinced differently on this.
Yeah.
Just because there was some very interesting concepts, ideas presented. It's really it's something else in some ways. Yeah, it's definitely not your normal movie for sure. So if you haven't watched it, definitely, please, if this gives you any inkling, give it a try.
And do then yourself come back a and service listen. And watch it, but also realize that it does get pretty brutal. There are some points that are very brutal in this movie, and that's Guillermo del Toro. That's what he does. It's not it's not often, but when it does happen, it hits hard.
Also, another fun fact that I found out while I was looking into this movie was that Guillermo del Toro actually wrote the subtitles for this movie because previous movies had done the subtitles, in his opinion, poorly. So he wanted to make sure it was translated correctly for the English audience. So what you see is what you get, and what we got was Pan's Labyrinth. So, the opener. Now we can talk about the opener. What did you think of that opener?
The way I wrote it, it is classic storybook. It's a storybook opener. It starts off the way telling you that we're already dealing with fantasy. We already know it's Pan's Labyrinth. Based on other experiences with Labyrinth and the name Pan, basically we're ending up with, it's, you know, we're already fantasy. We're starting with a storybook opening, and it kind of sets it up to seem like it's almost just all fantasy the entire way through. And then it goes through kind of telling the story of the Princess Moana as she escapes her captors and goes up into the normal world. And then we transition into not fantasy. Very grim. They're in a convoy mm-hmm. heading to the compound, and all fantasy is gone from that point for a while. And then we meet Ophelia, who, by rule of the Max cut, is Princess Moana. But mm-hmm. we don't know how that works yet. She's with her mother, and the opening... I'd say the opening basically ends after they meet the stepdad, the general.
Yeah, that's probably fair.
So we get all of these character introductions. We meet her mom, who's pregnant, and then we meet some of the staff that are working there, and then we meet the general, who her mom has married, presumably more out of the opportunity than out of love, mm-hmm. is what I kind of garner from that.
Yeah.
For the protection. And
you kind of get that impression, too, later on when she's basically like, can we leave here? Oh, why did you marry him? And all this kind of stuff. And she's and the mom is more or less like, you wouldn't understand, but there's other priorities when you get older kind of thing going on. Just briefly, you talked about the Pan's Labyrinth saying it was – were you thinking of – when were you saying Peter Pan? Is that like the connection in Pan? Okay, I'm curious what the – I'm trying to remember.
I'm trying to remember. Yeah, Pan is from a very specific mythology, if I recall. Pan is a Greek god of shepherds, hunters, and the wilds of nature.
Interesting. Okay, I should have known that. I don't know why I didn't know that.
So if you're able to at any point, you Google Pan and you go to images and you'll be like, oh, that's who it's supposed to be.
Okay.
It's a faun. It's Greek mythology of Pan being a faun. Ergo, he's kind of like the god of nature type stuff.
And is that who's supposed to be represented in this movie as the faun?
Yes, it is. Kind of a twist on it, only because he's not quite treated like a god in this movie.
Right.
He's more of like a middleman between the two realms.
Yeah, he's an interesting character.
Yes.
I think I did think the opener was pretty solid. It was, especially when it starts off with the daughter Ophelia going up to that little Norse or like the old Celtic statue thing kind of
with the eye missing, and she puts it in, and the bug comes out.
Yeah,
the bug, air quotes.
Yeah.
For those that are listening.
It's like a stick bug or a praying mantis or something.
It's like weirdly intelligent stick bug.
Yeah.
And, that can fly. And that's our first little hint at blurring lines between fiction and reality.
Yeah.
Because that, you can tell from the start, serves to be one of the fairies.
Yeah.
But it's a bug. So what is it actually? And who's to discern what is real and what isn't when we start getting to those points?
Right. Oh, interesting. That's a good point. That has implications for later on.
Yes, it
I
does.
I didn't think about that.
I'm just going to say one word as a spoiler for where I want that to go. Mandrake.
Yeah, it's an interesting... So anyways, the opener was good. I think it establishes the world pretty well. Everything you said is absolutely right. I'm really curious about your thoughts on Ophelia, especially as a main character. Is she have a compelling flaw or something missing in her life that drives her as a character forward very strongly in this movie?
So this is where things get a little complex, and having an education in developmental psychology kind of makes this a little more of a pain in the butt to address from a filmmaker's perspective. One, I'm not a filmmaker, so we're just going to start with that. Second, she's a child. That inherently comes with a bunch of character flaws that you work through as you mature. And this movie is about her maturing and making some mature decisions among certain other issues she's working with. But she reacts selfishly. She doesn't understand some of the complexities of the situation that she's in. She's flawed because she's young and inexperienced. She's flawed because she's a child. That's the main issue there. She's flawed because she's a selfish child. That's it. I mean, all of her problems that you can look at in the film, all of the mistakes that she makes in the film, come down to the fact that I'm going to use this term, you'll know kind of what I'm talking about. Impulse control, children are not really known to be the best at dealing with. If you're hungry, right. you're going to grab the nearest thing that looks tasty. It might be a very large, juicy grape. you're going to say things to people that are insensitive, and you might say the wrong thing to the wrong person, anything like that. And that's Ophelia's flaw, is she's a child. She's not the princess she wants to be. She still needs to grow up in a lot of ways.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. I wasn't thinking specifically of her flaws in regards to like her impulsiveness, but she definitely is very impulsive. She does the things that she wants to do. She even in some ways speaks very impulsively to the people around her, and that gets her into trouble sometimes. So that's definitely true. I was thinking especially of her naivety in regards to a lot of the world. She is the innocent child, right? And that actually becomes a big element of the final act of this story. But I agree with that. Nothing too much. I think that I put that middle of the road, but I could bump that up a little bit after having
that. And that's the thing is, it's not, for me, the reason why I rated that flaw very highly is because it's not artificial. That's a real thing. And it's well done in that, because I really like that this isn't some like, oh, she has this disorder that makes her, you know, impulsive, or she has this or whatever. It's like, no, she's just a child. Right. It's grounded that way because it's just how things are sometimes.
I think what was helpful about your monologue is that for a lot of people, I think the idea of a child is very stereotypically idealistic, right?
Yes.
It's almost like a child is the perfect form. They're young and innocent, and they don't know anything wrong. But there is that flip side that you were talking about where they are impulsive. They do these things that they shouldn't do, and they react irrationally.
In some way helped raise a child knows that children are not idealistic. They are. They can have elements of it, but they just are not, because they do not know things.
Right.
In psychological terms, there's a fun thing referred to as the age crime curve, which is where emotional intelligence and like semantic intelligence do not grow at the same time. So basically, like, you have a kid that's really smart with like math and government and politics and science and whatever, but then when it comes to regulating their emotions, their impulse, they just do the stupidest crap. Which is why you have parents going, if my kid's so smart, how can they be so dumb? Well, that's because they're a kid still, and they need to mature.
That's a great point. And you see that a lot in this character. So she definitely is believable.
Yes.
I'm on your side on that one, especially after that analysis. The side characters. What did you think about some of these characters like Mercedes, the mother, the Fawn? What are your thoughts?
Fawn didn't have as much like building upon him, like as far as you know, information that you can learn about him, but that's kind of like to his benefit, because the whole point is, you know, is this pre-established? Is this all in her head? Is this all just a fantasy that's been made up? Does she have the creativity to come up with a full backstory for that? Is this a book? Is this a storybook she's putting into reality? We don't know. It's vague for him. It's vague for all the fantasy-esque characters. For all of the other side characters, the mom has her history with, you know, how she lost her husband, I believe, in the war. The housekeeper, that's Mercedes, I believe.
Yeah.
She's very, like, very motivated. So is the doctor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I actually wrote down the housekeeper, doctor, mother, and the Fawn as the primary side characters.
I didn't write down the doctor, but I think it's fair to put him in there.
Yeah.
Because he does play a big role in the story.
I kind of loop the doctor and Mercedes together, as they both kind of have similar leaning subplots, but one is more emotionally invested in that subplot than the doctor is.
Mercedes' brother and all that.
Yep.
Yeah. I'm not sure where this fits in, but I'm really curious about this. So, and I think it really affects my rating. So I'm curious on your thoughts.
Yeah.
This movie has two very separate arcs going on at the same time. And at the end, they come together. But in the middle, they're kind of back and forth. And they interact some, but for the most part, they're very separate. Which one would you say is the A plot, the primary plot, and which would you say is the B plot?
That depends on whether or not I believe it to be actually happening or not.
Which, that's a whole nother point, right?
That and it changes entirely how I would view it, because I can see all I see all angles. It's just there's a lot of merit to both sides of it being real and it not being real, because if you look at it one way, if the fantasy aspect is real, then both plots, I'd say the fantasy plot is the A plot, only because we're clearly following the storybook. That's what started it. And this other side thing, part of the plot is keeping them separate.
Well, and that's so,
Ophelia's not trying to have them like merge because she's trying to not get caught. So that means there's an intent to keep both plots as separate as possible, where possible. Okay, so now we know there's already two plots. Yeah. If one is real and one isn't, if the fantasy one isn't real, can it truly be like differentiated between the two plots? Because then it's just she's having some sort of escapist delusion to cope with the horrible reality she lives in, which is the other plot would be dealing with. Or that's actually happening, and she's trying to become the princess by doing all these tasks while also dodging plot B, interceding and intersecting with that and potentially stopping that from happening. Mm-hmm. Which one do I think is the A plot? I think if the fantasy is real, fantasy is the A plot. If it isn't, then the Civil War plot, the only plot would be the real plot.
Okay. Yeah, I guess if you look at it as simply non-existent as a coping mechanism.
Yeah, but I mean, you could still look at it narratively as there's still a plot going where she's doing this, but then I think in a sense kind of deludes whether or not it's the main plot.
It's interesting to take that perspective because I didn't really think about it, and this is maybe a fault on my part, but
it always is. I'm kidding.
Okay, yeah. I say that to other people all the time, so that's a fair shot. Gosh, now I forget my point. No. So it opens, like you said, with the Fawn describing this fantasy world, more or less. And that's the setting that gives you what you have.
It gives you one plot line technically unrelated to the other one. The only linking thing is Princess Moana and Ophelia.
Right. And so there's two things about the existence of it or the non-existence of it that draw that into question, I guess. And the one that clearly comes to mind is when I forget who walks into the room, but there's a moment, I believe, in the movie where someone walks into the room and Ophelia's talking to the Fawn, but they don't see the Fawn. I'm trying to remember exactly when that was. I know it was later in the film. But there was a sense in which something she could see was something they could not see.
Was this before or after the funny little eye guy?
I believe it was after. I believe it might have been right after the mother dies. Now I'm questioning my own memory. But so anyways, there are moments where they have this indication that there's things that Ophelia is seeing that they aren't seeing, right? Or that they're not perceiving to some degree. But at the same time, I guess that initial setting that they give you, right, at the beginning of the movie indicates that this world exists. And they kind of put that setting out there and say, this is the world, blah, blah, blah. And us as an audience, especially for me as a first-time viewer, watched it and goes, oh, okay.
Yep.
In this hypothetical world, we are led to believe and are supposed to assume that this world actually exists.
Yes.
I wasn't really given much of a reason, I guess, but specifically to believe that it did not exist at all, actually. And it was simply a perception of her imagination, other than that scene. And maybe you could argue the very end. But as compared to, let's just say, The Sixth Sense,
which
plays into this idea of there is this all a reality and then perception shifts.
It clearly has an effect because, well, I mean, also like in arguing with The Sixth Sense, or as The Sixth Sense does, the what could have been not real is proven to be real based off of the fact that there are literal real life relations that it shows that there's no way he could have known if he didn't have this sixth sense. And in this movie, we do have something like that with the Mandrake, because she started getting better.
Yes.
She started getting better until they burned the Mandrake.
Yeah, which I thought that was an interesting piece because of
a little bit of a tease of like it might there's 100% evidence that it's real.
And it's also harkens back to like old historical understandings. Even you see that in the Bible where it talks about Jacob and his two wives, and one of them hires the other, the husband for the evening using mandrakes. Yes. Right? So it's like this idea of fertility and the health of women being tied to mandrakes is an old tradition.
I love them throwing that in there. It's just a nice little nod to it because we can look at the literal interpretations with mandrake, and then we can look at the more figurative ones. And this one uses both, and I love it.
So anyways, there's so much going on. I didn't want to get too caught up in the A-pop plot, B-plot. Suffice it to say, Patrick did not answer my question, which doesn't give me clarity, but I respect it because he has a nuanced view.
It's hard to answer this one. And that's the thing is, I technically did, but there's two ways you can go about it. Mm-hmm. And that ultimately is in how you interpret the film to be, which I love when a film does that. Except when I'm given a hard, hey, what's the answer to this?
Except for when I'm asking you this question.
Except
from right
when you're asking me the question that many people are like, that doesn't work. And if Del Toro thinks it works the same way with that. But
you mean like he intentionally put that in so you don't understand?
So you don't know the difference. But that plays into also looking at the film from the perspective of Ophelia. So I guess my answer is that because Ophelia is our unreliable narrator, but is our narrator regardless, I'm going to say plot A, the fantasy plot, is the main plot.
Sure.
Ultimately, she handles plot B as a sort of bobbing and weaving through it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But plot A is her escape from it. And that's her whole point of going through plot A is to escape it.
Right. Well, you get these expectations, and you see this with the side characters, and we're about to see with the villain as well, where she has these expectations, more or less, to give up this fantasy world, right? And the fantasy world even has a sense in which it itself is also dying, but you could say whether or not that's tied to her based on the analysis Patrick just gave is a whole other thing. But, you know, the idea is that she's being drawn out of this world that she wants to still believe is alive, and you see that in the book she's reading and all this stuff. And so can she continue to live in this world, or is she not going to, in the midst of the chaos of war going on around her? Mm-hmm. And that's one of the questions of this movie. And so it is kind of weird because in some ways she's going on her own little path, while at the same time everyone else is trying to, say, help insurrectionists or help the fascist leaders who are trying to tyrannically govern society at that time, right? So it's they're not super related other than Ophelia coming back and trying to take care of the mother, and that's where it's related. But it's this is the thing for me, and this is where, and we're about to get into this, but I'm just gonna say up front, the B plot for me was very compelling.
I love the B plot.
Very compelling. The A plot is kind of like interesting, but it's very, I don't know that it has the same draw that the B plot does.
It's very bare bones. It's very simple. It's very storybook. My ultimate kind of view of this, of the battle between A plot and B plot, my perspective, kind of like a spoiler for like what I view the main theme of the film to be, it's childhood trauma. It's addressing an escapism from childhood trauma and a kid finding themselves in a very bad situation, trying to grasp at straws for some way to cope with it. Because if you're watching from like the mom's perspective or the general's perspective, you have Ophelia running around just being weird and not addressing the world around her for what the reality of it actually is.
Right.
She's escaping it. She's ignoring it. She's denying it. It's a denial of reality is what she's doing, and that's what this movie is.
Yeah, and I can definitely see that. Especially for those side characters' perspective, 100% that's what's going on. So I think that does pretty much encompass leading directly into the idea of the motive for the main character.
There's no way we can really talk about it without kind of bringing these pieces together because that's the thing is, it's a strange movie. It's a very weird movie.
Yeah.
But the reason why is it's a bit more nuanced than just saying there's a fantasy world and there's a civil war in Spain.
Right.
It's more than that, because the fantasy world is directly related to a character reacting to the unfortunate reality she lives in. And that's what kind of dictates what's going on in the other world.
Yeah.
Because I think it's in her head.
I'm going to keep that in mind, but I you might be able to convince me of that by the end, yep, for sure. Like I said, there's a lot of things I left open.
I don't want to try to convince you. I'll just say my things, and that's
the— Oh, you should try to convince me.
Okay, I'll try. I'll do it. Okay. I might do it and not even try. How about that? We'll do that.
A salesman, I didn't even know it. The villain. I know we talked about it just briefly, but you want to expound on these characters.
I love Vidal. I hate to love him, but I also love to hate him.
That's how a good villain should be.
He's like, you immediately understand from the get-go when you first meet him that he's kind of a pain in the butt. He's very controlling. But you don't realize how evil he is until they catch the hunters. That was when I first saw this with my parents in 2007. I'll tell you, we weren't expecting that part. Essentially what happens is the soldiers on the compound catch these two hunters that are out in the woods, and they bring them to General Vidal, and they basically interrogate them, saying that you're bringing supplies to the, you know, to the insurrectionists or whatever. And they say, no, we were just hunting rabbits and squirrels. And one of the guys looks in the bag and doesn't see any rabbits and squirrels. So Vidal approaches the young man with a bottle and caves his face in with the bottle, and it shows it. Just like hitting him in the face with the bottle, and it shows it. And that's when I was like, oh boy, this is not what I was expecting at all.
Yeah.
Guess I'm going to keep watching. And we kept watching.
Patrick's like, I'm so excited.
I'm so excited for the gore.
Oh my gosh. Dude,
I remember silence in the room. We were like, oh, that's what we're dealing with. And that's not even the worst of it, I'd say.
No. I will say, so, man. And I say this before on this podcast, I'm not a gore guy, right? I can't.
He always says this in episodes I'm in. Anyways.
Because you make me watch these movies. But this was, I completely forgot about that happening because I saw it start. I'm like, I'm not watching this. And I looked away. But there's so much of that.
It's like, it's zero to 100.
Well, one thing that he does that was so interesting, and even I, not liking gore, had to acknowledge and appreciate in its own way, was how well, it's working, like, how he made, like, visually, how he made things occur that were just so jarring that you wouldn't forget it. Like how, for example, the way that Vidal gets hurt later in the film with the face. Like, that is so memorable that you won't forget it. And it's not even that, it's not the worst scar to get, right? Obviously, he can heal from that. But the fact is how he got scarred is so memorable. Or, for example, how the way that the other guy gets tortured later in the movie, the fact that he's missing a finger that goes all the way down to his digit is, like, so strongly, it's just so well developed that visual viewer are like, crap.
This director, Guillermo del Toro, uses violence in a way that isn't tasteless. It's always a thing to show how much of a monster a person is or how bad the situation is. Like that, like the scenes of violence, like there's a shootout later up in the forest dealing with the insurrectionists.
Yes, yes.
Not really the most violent thing. At least if you've watched any like war movies and stuff, it's not even as bad as that. It's only in like the up close and personal ones where you're learning how bad the person is or they're getting their just desserts. But typically it's done in a way to seem more monstrous of a character accompanied by probably the maiming of another. And in this case, Vidal, and Guillermo del Toro always does this, is he likes to give the villains a scar or like an injury to the face. He did it in Crimson Peak. He does it in Devil's Backbone and in a bunch of others. This is one where it's very obvious, and then he takes a shot of tequila, and that for me was the worst part.
That was like,
I didn't even think about that. Don't do that.
But that was I appreciated that too, even from I think this is getting into the more like nuanced kind of nerdy. Oh, I'm a film guy. I like that. Yeah. You know that kind of thing. Yeah. But it is interesting to think about. The ramifications of doing one thing and how that affects something else, right? So,
yes.
Like you said, he takes the shot of, I guess, tequila or whatever type of alcohol that is, vodka or whatever.
It's a tequila or a mezcal, but it doesn't matter. Anyways.
So he takes the shot, and because he's been scarred in the face, it affects the cut area of the face and burns and is painful. And you see how that affects him as the person consuming the alcohol. And as the visual person, you watch and you go, oh crap, like that just looks so painful.
And then I guess the other thing to kind of literally be the final nail in the coffin for Vidal, both of his major injuries were where? On the face.
True.
Yes. Yeah.
I was trying to think of the other one, but I got that.
Yeah.
We'll get to that.
Yeah, we'll get to that later. It's a major injury. It qualifies.
No, I'd agree. I think that one other thing notable about him is it wasn't that he was just a stock villain. And this is where he brought in – it wasn't that, he just does evil, evil things. And at first, I almost thought he was going to be one of those villains. But then you get some of these more nuanced areas where he goes, I want to preserve a lineage. And there's some level of pride in his progeny and who he's trying to be and what he's leading and his mission to defeat this resistance and the people who are fighting against him. That
almost all costs.
Yeah, literally no matter what. And there's I think there's even a discussion about that obedience to a certain degree. I don't remember how much of it was. I forget if that was with Ophelia or if that was with Mercedes.
I believe it was with Mercedes.
Okay.
And that was because he was suspecting something of the doctor at the time. And he was like kind of questioning her obedience and whatever. The other thing too was he's not about senseless violence. The reason he killed the dude with the bottle was because he perceived them to be deceiving him. Because what I said earlier was that the guy that searched the bag didn't see the animals.
Mm-hmm.
So that meant he's lying, which gives Vidal a reason to believe that he's working with the resistance. So he kills the guy. And then Vidal goes through the bag and finds that
there were
rabbits in the bag. And he can't take that back now, so...
And he's not remorseful, but he does say, like, hey, you messed up. This shouldn't have happened.
Yeah.
You know, what's going on here? Come on.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of thing. So, yeah, that's very true. Anyways, don't want to dwell too much on him. I just thought I'd appreciate that little note.
I love to dwell on him. Anyways, let's not. Vidal, I find compelling. Just straight up, I find Vidal very compelling.
You did mention themes. I don't want to dwell too much on that unless you want – if you think it's worth expounding on. Otherwise, we can talk about it in messages later on.
We can eventually talk about it in messages later, but I guess the main thing that I've seen throughout all of my different walkthroughs of this film is like a child coping with war.
Yeah.
So it's escapism. The fantasy is an escape.
Well, and that's interesting because I hadn't really thought about the aspect of – that fantasy world not existing at all, right?
Yeah.
And so with the assumption of it existing, I still think it has strong themes of like belonging.
It can go either way.
And
I just personally, I find, and that's probably because I'm more primed to think about it in a psychological way because of who I am as a human being.
Sure.
I find that the coping, and maybe there's nuance to say that it can go both ways, but I find that the coping itself makes the fantasy seem more like it is just a fantasy as opposed to an alternate reality colliding with the current reality they're in. But there's still room to say that that's the case. The good thing that I really like about this movie is it doesn't give you a 100% answer. So there's always a blend. And I like that because whenever I watch it, I can be like, all right, I want to see if I notice anything else.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes I do, sometimes I don't. And that's just how this movie goes. Sometimes you forget an old fact, and then sometimes you re-remember it.
Nice. Yeah. No, that's very, very true. And there is some degree, and this maybe ties more to your theme you're going with, but there's this idea of innocence or the childhood innocence that's going on here. And I thought that was definitely a very strong theme with how everything played out. So
look at the way... adults cope versus children coping. Children tend to create something that's fantasy-esque. It's fictional. It's not real. It's more innocent. It's more laced with a kind of innocence, childlike innocence, versus adult coping mechanisms are usually more self-destructive, or they just turn to things like dark humor and things like that. People that work in very traumatizing fields will go to dark humor as their go-to coping mechanism. Children don't have that. They go with what is something that makes them happy. And in this case, she reads fiction. She reads fantasy stories. So it influences her coping mechanism.
What did you think about the heightened tension of the movie? Was the movie consistently putting the hero in a worse situation as it progressed?
Oh, yeah. And it's like she doesn't realize it sometimes up until it's already reached a point of being pretty bad. Key point would be when, spoilers, her mom dies giving birth to her child.
Right.
To Vidal's child. That means that Ophelia has technically no familial ties to Vidal anymore.
Right.
And she looks at that as like a form of escape, which means that she's stuck in this situation with nobody that cares for her that she's aware of except Mercedes. So I'd say that's getting pretty bad. Your mom just died. You're stuck with a horrendous stepfather in the middle of a war-torn country, and it's getting worse. You've messed up your task. You ate the berries or you ate the grapes and things went sour.
So I'm going to push back, but
go for
definitely
it.
Go with, I'm curious to hear your thoughts. Anyways.
Yeah.
I think the B plot is fantastic. Absolutely fantastic with pushing the tension. Things are always getting worse. Somebody's leg gets sawed off. People are getting captured and then tortured. And, you know, people are getting closer to being caught.
I actually forgot about that.
I also did not watch that.
They didn't show it.
Yeah. As you can see, I look away a couple times when I watch films. So, yeah, B-plot, super good at building up the tension. Super good with especially the villain who's very compelling that drives this part of the story forward.
Yes.
I think the A-plot was where I kind of got lost. And that was specifically because so she has three trials that she goes through to become Princess Moana. The first one was kind of
frog? I forget.
The frog, yeah.
Yeah.
So the frog was like it was interesting. It was odd. She gets the dress dirty.
And I think that's literally its only significance. It's that kind of thing that tells me maybe she's just going out and prancing about in the mud, thinking she's trying to go get some key, and she gets her dress dirty. And that directly affects B plot. Because the dress was for the dinner, and the mother gets mad and all of that. And that's the thing is, A plot and B plot are technically separate things. All of the events that happen are separate from B plot. But everything that happens in A plot affects something in B plot in some way.
So, okay. Definitely with the first section, right? The second one with the... what's his name? With the weird monster.
Pale Man.
The Pale Man.
They call it the Pale Man. Which, as a separate little short, is terrifying, and I love it.
Oh, yeah. As its own, if you were to take just that section and cloister it off, it's a great short story, you know? It's so good.
Oh, yeah.
I think that was a great example of, hey, don't... It was a little odd, but also explainable, because she's a child, that he goes, hey, by the way, don't eat any of the food at the table. This is a big deal. And then she eats the food at the table. And you go, okay, you're stupid. But then you also go, well, she's a child.
She's a child, and she's literally in war-torn Spain.
Right.
You think she's going to, like, not want to eat a grape? She doesn't know what's going to happen.
Yeah, and that's the thing is we as audience are doing the horror movie, like, what are you doing? You stupid. Yeah. Don't do that. But
I can say also, when you look at that grape, that's a juicy looking grape. Like, I don't know where they got the props for this, where they got the grape. I would have eaten that grape. That was a really good looking grape. And you can tell by the bite, it was the best grape. It was not the best situation after, but it was the best grape.
Of course. No, but they got the pale man, you know, sitting at the table with his hands on the table and the two eyeballs on the plate in front of him, right?
Yeah.
And he's just sitting there doing nothing until she eats the grape. And when she eats the grape, this guy takes the eyeballs, puts them in his hands, which are the hands are the things he's that hold the eyeballs.
He's got the eye holes in his hands.
Yeah, the sockets like in the hands. And then he holds them up to see out. It's such a it's just a little off, right?
It's a
normal person, but he's pale. He's got the red fingertips. He's got the eyes sockets in the hands. It's just that little bit that is very disturbing from a visual perspective. And you go, oh crap, here we go.
Oh Lord, he coming.
Yeah, exactly. So it's that was a great
scene. You wanna know how that links into B plot.
Well, I am curious.
This is the thing. The reason why, like, this is one of those where, one, I love the set. I love the set and everything and how all that goes through. But this is one of those that contributes more to the ambiguity of it. Because what does she get from there? What does she take from that place?
Like the knife. Is it a knife or scissors? I wasn't sure which one it was. It looked like it was a knife. Okay.
It's the knife she has to use, I believe, to cut herself to feed the mandrake her blood. Which then directly affects her mom's health.
I thought she bit her hand to do that.
I thought she cut it. Hold on. I'm going to fact verify because I have it open on the other screen because that's what I do.
It definitely had to do with the end of the movie, for sure.
It did, and yes.
So
and
it's not like it doesn't have relevance, but it was and you start to see how it all plays into each other. That's what I assumed, was that it had relevance for the ending
she
of
did
the story.
Bite. You're correct. She did bite.
So it's still relevant, but the
it doesn't have a direct consequence, technically, but also, which makes you wonder, because I believe she's carrying the knife at the end of the movie, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if the fantasy thing didn't happen, how'd she get the knife?
Well, is she carrying it at the end? That's a good question.
Let's fact verify.
Because she gives it to the fawn, but maybe she gets it back at the end?
That's right, she gave it to the fawn.
So,
again, promoting ambiguity.
Yeah, it is interesting. And you do see, to be clear, and this doesn't confirm that it's real or not, but you do see the chalk on the wall where she makes the wall that she pushes through and then finds this fantasy world where all this stuff occurs. For you listening, if you haven't seen this movie before, you're just listening to all this dialogue, you're like, what are you guys talking about? It's a very weird film, right?
Yes.
But there is a lot of
it makes sense
dimension.
When you watch it. It makes more sense when you watch it. The ambiguity we're talking about comes down to just like a further, more in-depth analysis. If you watch the film wanting to be entertained, it's a pretty entertaining film.
Right.
It's a very bittersweet film, but it's a very entertaining film. And it makes sense if you're just watching it to watch it.
Yeah.
So don't let conjecture scare that away.
Yeah, and we're slipping between conjecture and then explaining specific scenes and between scenes. But to be clear, like there is a... it's regular for the main character Ophelia to jump between the fantasy realm and the real realm, quote unquote.
I was going to say, and also we should clarify too that there's technically like maybe two jumps between fantasy and reality, and I'm going to say air quotes jumps because they're all in places where it would 100% be justified for a kid to just imagine they're doing it. Like, nobody's in the forest to fact verify that Ophelia crawls into the tree. Or nobody's there in the room for her to verify that, or to verify that she went into a hole in the wall. None of that is something that is solidly known.
Well,
or that could say actually happened.
And I will ask you a question about this later on that might be another push on this issue. But we're not quite there, so we're gonna move on.
Yep.
I think... I don't want to dwell too much on the idea of her loss. I want to get on to revelations.
Yep.
But would you agree that the idea of her world-shattering loss was when her mother died?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah,
okay.
Definitely.
Thought so. Didn't want to like dwell too much on that, but I think that that's a fair analysis because that's really where her real tragedy is experienced.
Yep.
The revelations of the movie. Is there a big revelation in this movie, and does it have a surprise ending?
Not particularly like a big revelation.
Mm-hmm.
There's a revelation that says that Mercedes, her brother, is in the resistance in the mountains.
Right, right.
And the doc is working with her. Okay, great. I think that's about it for revelations, apart from maybe one particular one at the end, which for me kind of feels like a little bit of a shoe-in with the way that the ending goes. But we'll get to that in a bit.
Sure. Well, I mean, this might be the appropriate time to talk about the surprise ending. I honestly, when you said that about the brother, that's the only thing I could think of that might be a surprise revelation. It's really strongly hinted that there's ties to the resistance fighters anyways.
Yeah.
So the fact that Mercedes has a brother who's a part of it is like, okay, you know, whatever. Like, it's okay. She has extra reason to be involved, but you weren't surprised that she was part of the resistance fighting.
Yeah, exactly. Core. Maybe one more revelation would have been like the ending confrontation with Vidal at the labyrinth. The Fawn tells her to sacrifice her brother, her newborn brother.
Right. Right.
Which I take that as that's kind of a big revelation. Not the biggest, because at this point, what else could we expect? I was going to draw a comparison to the twist being kind of like a shoo-in of like Abraham and Isaac.
Right.
And the sacrifice, and oh, that's actually the kid that needs to be sacrificed. And that's kind of a twist that felt lackluster to me. One of the only ones that, like, with all the buildup, there was kind of nothing hinting at that except maybe a sacrificial knife, clearly a sacrificial looking knife.
Because that's gotta be plunged it was into ominous. Something.
It's an ominous knife. That is a knife that wants to be plunged into an infant, I guess.
Oh, jeez.
But. Like, as far as surprises go, this movie really didn't have any.
Yeah, and that's, like, I say this all the time, saying it again. The, I think, revelations of unique surprise endings, that's one of the hardest things to do.
Yeah.
It's not required for a great story.
Yeah.
If they do, kudos to them, you know, that kind of thing. But it's not required. That's just what they put them on the upper tier of films that are out there.
And I think in particular with this one, because this movie is a pretty straightforward movie anyways, as far as like the plot goes, it's literally got a storybook opening. We know how the storybook is supposed to go.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's going to be some more tragedy to it, but ultimately like the general plot line is going to be very straightforward. There's not going to be a lot of room for surprises because it's already working with putting a twist on a very formulaic kind of thing.
Right. Well, and I think the twist is supposed to be that by sacrificing herself, you see that she actually fulfills the obligation of the innocent child that needs to be sacrificed, right?
Yep.
I'm not going to lie. When I saw this, and this is not what happened for you listening, but what I thought it was trying to say was when Mercedes comes in right after she dies, I thought, is Mercedes actually the princess and Moana was the sacrifice? Ophelia was a sacrificial child. And I thought, wow, that's really surprising. I didn't expect that. I thought that wasn't what happened. So I was like, okay. That's
definitely not what happened. I get why you would think that, only on a very minute scale. That's hilarious. Next time I show somebody that movie, if I know they're not watching closely enough, I'll like just throw that in at the end. Oh yeah, it was actually Mercedes the whole
time. See what they say.
What? Just to mess with them, you know.
That's pretty good. Because here's the thing, they have like little hints that she's raised in the same way that Ophelia is.
Yes.
She has a lot of similar touch points to Ophelia. And so you get the sense in which like, oh, maybe it is the same thing. It's just she's, because Ophelia is painted as this innocent little child.
Yeah.
And so to have her be the true child sacrifice that's depicted in the statue underneath the moonlight is not that much of a stretch. So
I should also address that child sacrifice isn't a normal theme in movies that I watch. And it was kind of tacked on at the end too by the Fawn. Because Ophelia makes it into the labyrinth with her brother during the last portion of the movie, and then that's thrown at her.
It's like a surprise where he's like, "Do you trust me? Do you trust me?"
Yeah,
yeah.
There's no infant stabbing in this movie. It doesn't happen. So for those of you that wanted that, so sorry. For those of you that don't, I'm glad you're normal. Anyways,
that's right. No, there's no children being stabbed by sacrificial knives. So in that ending, this is the thing that I wanted to highlight earlier. was the when we're talking about the intersection between the real world and the fantasy world.
Yeah.
There is this situation where Ophelia is running away from the fight that's happening at the compound. Mm-hmm. And when she runs away, she goes into the labyrinth with her brother or her stepbrother or mm-hmm. half-brother. Sorry, whatever. And the villain, Vidal, follows her. And when they go through the labyrinth...
Yeah, when the Ophelia, walls open up and yeah, they let the her through. The walls
open up
yep.
and she goes through and then he comes over and he can't go yep. through that wall. The wall exists, so it clearly has some sort of barrier.
Yep.
So how
and
does that...
And that's the thing about this movie is, again, there's merit for both arguments.
Uh-huh.
I can tack on whatever I want to about the trauma aspect of it. It's 100% yeah. there, but also so are some of the things to insinuate that there's a fantasy aspect that's there and there's nothing you can do about it. All of your little theories, they're bunk.
Oh, answered.
They don't
Dude,
work.
You keep doing this to me. You're like this, the
because
thing,
this movie, this
you're
movie
just
is
like,
a perfect
we don't know.
But that's the thing. And well, I mean, with the thing you're dealing with Lovecraftian, it's that there's a reason you don't know because it's sure, incomprehensible sure. with this, sure. with this. It's just because like when you blend fantasy and reality in this way, because there's no hard answers given, there's no hard solution to it.
Mm-hmm.
As much as I want a perfect like understanding of the movie, I don't think I would like it as much if I understood it perfectly.
Nice.
Only because like
I guess that's fair.
It's got a lot of ambiguity to it to help feed the idea of it's a blend of fantasy and reality. You're dealing with only one person's perspective, technically.
I think that the ending is really interesting. I think especially because in the end, and this has to do with themes, so we might as well, like, or messages, we might as well deal yeah. with that now. But this yep. idea that, oh, you died, and that is how you get to the fantasy realm. Like,
you pass
what
go and collect $200.
Yeah.
there's a few ways that I look at it. One, if it is the fantasy ending where that's how you got into the fantasy world, lackluster.
Well, yeah, I did feel a little cheated.
Yes, the other way I look at it is she's dying, and that's all stuff that she's feeling and seeing before she fully dies.
I'm trying to remember. Is the last thing you see her body or her in the fantasy realm?
The last thing you see in relation to it all is her body. Because then it does like a long long shot zooming out of the labyrinth, and then it goes back to the tree from the start of the movie. And then the credits roll. What that tells me is perhaps the fantasy ended after she died, because she died. And I think what she was seeing was her finding some semblance of joy and in completion in her story in her dying moments.
Dude.
Which is a very bittersweet ending to the movie, because it's like, darn it.
Yeah, it's like... Because there's a sense in which you have, I almost, and this is where I get drawn off a little bit by the movie, but mm-hmm. there's a sense in which I almost feel like that ending where they have the twist of, oh, you are the sacrifice, and by doing this correctly, you actually gained entry into the
fantasy realm.
It was
a test the whole time.
Right. That whole thing.
You spared an innocent life and sacrificed your own innocent life, and now you get to go to the fantasy world down under.
Which almost, okay, that's actually a point because it is down under and she's considered, what, the daughter of the underworld, which indicates, if anything, that there is already this initial tie to death. So that's an interesting aspect, too, that I hadn't mm-hmm. thought of until just
yep.
now.
Her whole goal in this movie, the way I've always seen it is the story is her telling it to herself. Because she's able to, and of course there's always going to be exceptions because of the way they film this movie and the way that it's organized. But the general thing is that like the whole point is her becoming a better person as much as she can, committing more selfless acts for starting mm-hmm. off by doing selfish acts. She's still a child, so you can only expect that. And at a certain point, completing the story in her mind because the reality just sucks. She gets shot by her stepdad, the general, and
yeah.
she dies on the ground there. And so this, then while she's dying is when she sees that she wakes up basically in like the courtroom and the Fawn is there.
Right.
It's a very weird looking courtroom with the chairs that I wonder how you even got up there to sit on.
How did you climb up to that
height? How did you get up there?
Yeah.
Did you fly?
Yeah, exactly.
But then yeah. basically like the queen says, you know, you passed all the tests and the Fawn was there the whole time, blah, 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 whatever. And yeah. as that scene closes, we zoom out to see Ophelia. As that scene closes, Ophelia dies.
Yeah.
And that's the last we see of anything fantasy, because then the yeah. last thing is a few shots of the trees and then the bug at the end from the start of the movie.
That's the idea. So you could take it one of two ways. Like he said, either one, you could take it that the fantasy world is real and she got the task done, which is and achieved the goal of entering the fantasy realm, right? Or you could take the concept that
the more this was like this coping. Disgustingly sad concept of coping during wartime and then dying because of an awful stepfather.
Yeah. So either way, I think it has at least an interesting ending. I think it's a little more disturbing for the one. So if you don't like that ending, just believe the other one and you're good.
Yeah. Yep. And there's merit for both. And that's the thing is this is a movie that I keep saying it. There's enough evidence for both sides. But because there's evidence for both sides, there's not one answer on which one's real and which one isn't. That's not mm-hmm. how it's answered.
Yeah.
Hey, was the setting believable?
Yeah. I mean, yeah. I thought they did pretty good at balancing that, so I didn't yeah. think it was a big issue in my part. Most times, people do pretty well at
yeah.
setting a believable world. Because you, yeah. as an audience, buy into it pretty easily. You're accepting this is a film, this is a world, however the world is set up. And if yeah. they set it up well, you buy into it. It's not hard yep. to get this. It's just those few times where they don't do that you have to acknowledge this took me out of the movie because yeah. you set up your rules for how this world exists and then you broke your own rules. Yes. That's kind of a problem. So didn't yeah. do that. Really satisfied with that. But did you get satisfied with the ending and how it all left you?
I love a bittersweet ending. And for me, mm-hmm. this movie always screams a very bittersweet ending. More bitter right. than sweet. I am always satisfied with this movie.
I got it like somewhat for me, to be honest. It was yeah. interesting, right?
Yeah.
It has a different feel than the rest of the movie in some degrees because it's yes. really like bright and shiny it's in this other jarring. World.
It's a little too jarring sometimes, but
yeah.
when I look at it this way, it's like it's not only bright and shiny at the end in the fantasy realm, but it also is in the real world because mm-hmm. Vidal and all of the fascists have died.
True.
And Vidal was the last one to die. So everyone there.
Right.
wakes up to a better day, essentially.
That's a good point. I mean, this doesn't complete the A plot, but it definitely no. gives extra satisfaction to the B plot.
Yeah. And that's the thing is the A plot is so ambiguous regardless that I feel like completing it would require the A plot to be massively longer or have like way longer scenes in it. But what we sure, got sure. was enough to keep it ambiguous.
Right.
Is there satisfaction in the A plot? Technically, yes. Do I find it satisfying? Not particularly. But when I look at it yeah, in the way yeah. of like the combination of A and B working together to build the themes that I was talking about earlier with trauma and coping, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. wartime and children, I think it's a satisfying ending. It's sad because of how it ends for Ophelia, but that's a reality.
Right, and I guess that's the idea of, like, reality versus the – and maybe this is a more metaphysical or philosophical discussion. Like, what is yeah. Is the quote-unquote realistic ending the right ending, right? And so when I was thinking of bittersweet endings, I was thinking of La La Land, which we haven't reviewed on this podcast, but it has, in my mind, the quintessential – bittersweet ending, but it ends the right way where you yeah. go, oh, this is so sad, but at the same time it's right for both the characters yeah. in the story.
Yep.
And I think that in this one you get some of that bittersweet, but you also get the like, is this the right ending for these characters?
This movie is one of those where it's so weird because it brings an ontological discussion into what like ontology being the study of like it's the metaphysical study of like being of what is what's real. Uh-huh. And this is a movie where in order to like pick an ending that you feel satisfied with, you have to give yourself this ontological argument for either side of it in order to be like, all right, I liked what I saw. I know I do. The ending had a satisfaction that I cannot access yet. And I don't uh-huh. know why. And uh-huh. I need to know. So I have to watch it again and look at all the different things because it's one of those movies where you got to watch it. Now you know where it's going. Now you know what to look for more.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's like, all right, when those scenes interact, I need to see everything. What's going on? Yeah. Are there links? Is there anything like that? And Guillermo del Toro is very detail-oriented. Mm-hmm. He's very detail-oriented.
Yeah. Yeah.
You could tell by the everything of this film.
The everything, yeah.
The everything.
He's, yeah. He does well with all the nuances, which I did appreciate, as we said before.
Yeah.
And as we said again, it's what you make of it, right?
So it's what you make of it.
Would you change your rating, Patrick, based on our discussion?
Honestly, I would keep it, like, because it pumped out an 8.75. I'd keep it at, like, an 8 at a 7.5 to 8, or 7.75 to 8 in that range.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, there are issues with kind of, like, too much ambiguity at times with this movie.
Sure.
But
sure.
I still really enjoy this movie.
Yeah. No, and I think that you made a couple solid points. It bumped it up 0.4 for me, so that gives it a 6.55, which is higher than it was before.
Yeah,
I think, and that was what I was expecting, to be honest, was that this one was a little ambiguous for me.
Yes,
in a couple points, and I was expecting, like, if this made a little more sense to me, I would totally be on board.
I
wouldn't say that for every movie you've recommended for me, but this one definitely.
I think definitely, like, explore just on your own time. Explore some of Guillermo del Toro's other films.
Yeah.
There's some that are, like, a lot more accessible in terms of, like, linear plot lines. Actually, I think generally most of them are. But you'll also kind of, like, be, oh, now I can recognize Guillermo del Toro's style anywhere because it's so specific and you've seen this one.
Oh, boy.
I don't know if you'd be able to. Once you see, like, the first few scenes of one of them, you'll be like, okay, yep, that's Guillermo del Toro. I know what this looks like now.
Okay. All right. Thanks a lot.
it's so specific and everyone will notice it once they see it. Same thing with the writing and all of that. He's very fun. He's very fun and he has a lot of fun with his filmmaking. Nice. Fun fact, he had, if I recall, like, he was involved with something a long time ago where, like, he or, like, some family members of his were kidnapped or something like that. And if I recall, he is friends with James Cameron. And James Cameron essentially, like, paid off the people that had, like, kidnapped his family. And he rescued Guillermo del Toro's family or something like that.
Wow. That's crazy.
So he has a lot of messed up past stuff that he just throws into his movies that you're like, yep, Toro. That's del Toro. I love it.
Yeah. Well, and yeah, that gives a whole new perspective to that, I'm sure, for him as a creator of stories himself.
Oh, yeah.
There you go. That's Guillermo del Toro, and that is Pan's Labyrinth. There we are. Yeah. We hope you all enjoyed. We will be back, as we always are, every week. Next week, you'll see us then, because we'll be here.